If you enjoy listening to Clinical Conversations, why not become a member of the Royal College of Physicians of Edinburgh? Our membership provides you with access to the RCPE educational portal, the live evening medical updates, and you have options to view the symposia both in person or online. If you would like to learn more about this, please go to the Royal College of Physicians of Edinburgh website.
Hi, and welcome to this episode of Clinical Conversations. My name's Kat Ralston. I'm a member of the Royal College of Physicians of Edinburgh Trainee and Members Committee, as well as a Medicine of the Elderly Registrar in Edinburgh. And today we're going to talk about the topic of clinical debriefing. I'm delighted to introduce Dr. Emma Phillips, who's an Anaesthetics Registrar in South East Scotland and a simulation educator with a Master's in Clinical Education. Emma's published several pieces on clinical debriefing, including a systematic review of clinical debriefing tools, which we'll link to in the show notes, and has lots of experience in clinical debriefing in practice. Welcome, Emma.
Hi, Kat. Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for such a lovely introduction.
Very welcome. So I thought it might be useful, I guess, just to set the scene a little bit. So my journey into clinical debriefing has exponentially increased, I guess, in the last couple of years. But when I was a new registrar, I wasn't really aware of it or how to do it or what it needed to include. And I hope through this podcast, we can try and help people who are listening in that journey too. And I guess I think back to a time when I was a new registrar in a district general hospital and there was a cardiac arrest, probably a fairly straightforward cardiac arrest, but definitely things I think we could have learned from at that point. By the end of it, everyone just kind of walked away and we all went back to seeing patients on the wards or seeing patients in the emergency department. And I thought afterwards, this could have been a good opportunity to think about maybe what could have been better. This was in COVID. And I thought the time to defibrillation with PPE was a bit tricky and thinking about how we could maybe have reduced that. And also I thought something that was really good was one of the healthcare assistants came with a big platter of juice at the end and everyone had a lovely juice. And I thought that was really helpful to the team. So just thinking about what went well, what was maybe more challenging and maybe what we could do next time as a team could have been really useful after that experience. And that's perhaps what started my journey in being interested in clinical debriefing. And I wonder whether to start, A, what you think about that, Emma, and B, can we just talk about what we're actually talking about when we're saying clinical debriefing?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that story resonates with me and I'm sure it will with a lot of the listeners. But my sort of entry to clinical debriefing, probably very similar. So as a more junior anaesthetist or even more junior to that, participating in lots of clinical events and you wander off afterwards and just think, wow, we could have maybe all had a bit of an opportunity to talk about that afterwards and that didn't happen. So I think in terms of what I understand by clinical debriefing, and there's lots of different definitions out there, but this is essentially where there's a guided exploration and usually a reflection of clinical events, whether those are emergency or routine. We'll probably talk about that a bit more in a minute, in an attempt to bridge the gap between the actual experience of the staff and the understanding of what's happened, usually with the aim of learning from this to try and influence future practice. And I guess the ultimate goal is to try and improve patient safety as a result of all of that.
Yeah, thanks. That's a really nice explanation. And I guess you've alluded to the fact that the ultimate goal is to learn and to try and improve patient outcomes. So can you tell us a bit more about the benefits of clinical debriefing? Why is this something that we should be doing?
There's a huge body of evidence now supporting clinical debriefing. So I think if you looked into this on PubMed maybe 5-10 years ago, there was a real paucity of literature. Whereas now you can find evidence ranging everything through from staff saying, yes, we quite like this. Yes, this is helping us learn. This is helping us feel better after these events. All the way up to actually, we know that doing this can improve clinical outcomes for patients in certain contexts. So an example of that, there was a paper that was published quite a few years ago, actually, by Wolf et al. And that was looking at a clinical debriefing program implemented following cardiac arrest. And they had shown improved neurological outcomes in patients as a trend as this clinical debriefing program was implemented, with a trend towards overall survival as well, which is remarkable. So I think there is real convincing evidence out there, which is great, but I think does prompt the question, why are we not doing this more?
Yeah, so that's really interesting that this real body of evidence that supports clinical debriefing is something that's improving outcomes, performance, how we are in relationships as teams, and also thinking about systems improvement, but we're not doing it all the time. And we'll dig into that in a wee minute. So I think it might be useful at this point to think a bit more about what the purpose of our clinical debriefing in the way that we're talking about it is. Because I think sometimes people get a bit caught up in thinking we need to debrief the emergencies where it's been really awful or really traumatic or something terrible has happened, and actually think about what are we trying to do when we're debriefing.
Yeah, definitely. So that's a point that I'm really, really passionate about, which is actually, why are we doing this? So we've already alluded to the fact that we can do clinical debriefing to help us learn from events. And that might be to try and improve staff understanding, staff performance, team performance, improve systems with that ultimate goal of patient safety. But actually, what are we doing for the staff as well? Because we've all been in that situation where you participated in a really challenging clinical situation and you go away maybe not feeling brilliant about that. And staff members can suffer all sorts of adverse events after this, like feeling anxious, depressed, and end up having to go off sick and everything in between. So it is also an opportunity to look out for our staff members, giving them that opportunity to just sit down and have a chat about what's happened. So there was a brilliant paper that if you're only going to read one thing on clinical debriefing, I would encourage you to read. And it's a paper called Team Debriefings in Healthcare, Aligning Intention and Impact. And that's by Michaela Cole and colleagues. And this really clearly delineates different purposes of clinical debriefing. So it talks about debriefing to learn, debriefing to manage, and debriefing to treat. So debriefing to learn is that first one that we've talked about there. So usually using a sort of what went well, what was challenging kind of structure, coming up with some learning points and taking them forward. But sometimes that might not be appropriate if it's been maybe a very emotive situation, and debriefing to manage, i.e. managing the emotions of the participants, is a bit more important. What's really critical is not to tread into that debrief to treat as non-experts. So debriefing to treat, which is that like real psychological debriefing, we know if it's done by people that don't know what they're doing, can actually put people at higher risk of adverse outcomes like PTSD. So unless you're a psychologist, a psychiatrist, or someone that's really been experienced with debriefing, that should be parked. And really focusing on that debrief to manage, which is just a, I guess, really superficial checking everyone's all right, giving people a chance to diffuse, and really importantly, creating safety nets for people that need it for follow-up support.
Yeah, I also love that paper, and it's got such a helpful graph that just shows you the three different types of debriefing, which is really useful to visualize. And just thinking about that, how would you suggest people decide debriefing to learn versus debriefing to manage? You know, where does that fit in terms of deciding after an emergency or after an event what direction you're going in?
That, Kat, is a really good question. And if you know the answer to it, I'd love you to tell me. So I think the overall answer is I don't know, because I don't think that's easy, especially if the person conducting the debrief doesn't have a lot of experience in conducting debriefs. I suppose a little bit of it is just being sensitive to the room, being sensitive to the context. Actually, did this situation sound like it might have been emotionally challenging? Is this something that people might be upset by and need to have a bit of a chat about from an emotional perspective rather than learning? And then you might lean towards a debrief to manage. If it's not as obvious, I think it's important to screen for those emotions in some way. And that might just be as simple as sitting down and doing that kind of temperature in the room sort of thing, actually. A bit of a quiet look around. How are people looking? How are people acting? Or asking them, you know, how are you all feeling after that? If everyone appears to be totally okay in themselves and they're happy to move on to analysing the clinical event and talking about learning points, that seems appropriate to do. But there's probably some nuances in there in terms of that facilitator being able to pick up if people aren't quite okay and then going towards a debrief to manage. But I don't think that's easy.
Yeah, I think I definitely agree with you. And a lot of the tools have that kind of reactions phase, kind of temperature check built into them, which I think is a useful thing. So I would agree a lot of it is around reading the room, and actually if everyone is fine, then debriefing to learn, grand. But if actually there's a lot of emotion in the room or it's been difficult, an emergency, then you may be moving into that manage section more. And I think people might also be worried about a clinical debrief forming part of like an investigation into a significant event, reviewing things. What would you say to that?
Yeah, I think you're right. In terms of appreciating what clinical debriefing is, it's really important to appreciate what it is not. So it is not a psychological therapy, like we've already discussed. It is not a replacement for morbidity and mortality investigations, data edge reporting, serious adverse events inquiries. Those are usually built into the infrastructure of a department or a hospital. And while this may complement it, it definitely doesn't replace it. And similarly, I don't think putting that sort of pressure on a clinical debrief, because quite often these are done quite quickly after an event's happened and in quite a short period of time, you don't have the time to cover things that would come up in, for example, a morbidity or mortality meeting. So that's quite nice to clarify at the start of a debrief for people that aren't used to doing them, just to make sure they know what to expect from the debrief.
Yeah, I think that's really important. So having that clarity of purpose and intention of the debrief being really clear when you're doing it. And I guess just to be clear to the listeners, what we're going to talk about sort of in the rest of the podcast is this debriefing to learn type of clinical debriefing. And that might have been known by some people as hot debriefing in the past. Any other names, Emma, that people might have called this?
Yeah, I have a list actually, because I wrote this list for something else. And I think it's funny how many different names there are. So you've got sort of hot debriefs, cold debriefs. We discussed whether we were going to call it clinical debriefing or clinical event debriefing. You've got proximal debriefs, after action reviews, which I think in Australia, they're quite keen on that term. So lots of different things that people might call it that are alluding to the same thing, which is sitting down after an event, having a chat about it.
Yeah, just make it easy.
Yeah.
Okay, so I think we've alluded to the evidence that clinical debriefing has a lot of clear benefits, and there's a really nice editorial that we'll link to in the show notes as well, which has the best title of a paper I think I've read, Stop Asking If It Works, Start Making It Happen for Clinical Debriefing, I think is really nice. So I think that's telling us there's a lot of variability in whether this clinical debriefing is done in practice. And I wonder if you've got any insights into, if clinical debriefing is so useful, why aren't we doing it routinely? What's stopping us?
Yeah, you're right. I think all the evidence out there telling us that clinical debriefing works should have convinced us to start doing it more. But time after time, we're finding that that's not the case. I also really like that paper that you're talking about. And they talk about four potential barriers that are what are contributing to us not doing clinical debriefing routinely. So I think we've already talked about lack of clarity of purpose, which is actually not understanding why we're doing it. That's a really important one. Time is very frequently cited. Culture and also skills, or a lack of skills in terms of actually how to do the debrief and who is going to do the debrief. So I think those are probably the four main ones. There's lots of ideas of how we can get around these, but to me, culture is the real overarching one, because that is difficult. We know changing culture in healthcare is really, really challenging, and it doesn't happen overnight. So I think you can come up with lots of ideas for them and how to create a little bit more time in your clinical environment, but changing the culture is challenging.
Yeah, and we'll get into that a bit later. Just, I guess, thinking about our own experiences in the literature about what can be helpful in trying to embed debriefing within your department. But first, it would be useful, I guess, to look at some of those other challenges, particularly the ones around feeling like you have the skills or ability to lead a clinical debrief. So first, I think it'd be useful to talk about when we should be doing clinical debriefing.
Yeah, I think in terms of when we can do it, after anything at all, really sky's the limit in terms of when you can do a clinical debrief. But if you're going to really broadly differentiate different opportunities, we can think about doing this routinely. So after a routine clinical event, that might be the end of a theatre list, or the end of an on-call shift, the end of a ward round, or it might be prompted, which is generally after something more unanticipated, after a cardiac arrest. Importantly, I think if anyone wants a clinical debrief, any member of staff, that's probably the right time to do it. So if someone's raising the question, we should do a clinical debrief, we should do a clinical debrief.
Yeah, that makes absolute sense. And I've been speaking to people about clinical debriefing after events like an emergency or cardiac arrest. And actually, people have really liked the idea of that routine debriefing as well. So just after shift debriefing, which I think could be really useful. I think the emphasis should be on clinical debriefing of everyday work. So I know I mentioned at the start about extreme or traumatic events and people feeling like people need to debrief that. And actually, that's probably going into the debrief to manage and supporting your team, not the debriefing to learn. And I always think this has sort of links to that safety one and two thinking. So traditionally in hospitals, we learn and investigate when things have gone wrong. But actually, that's 2% of our work. And actually, if we focus on learning from the spectrum of our work and then 8% of everything else, then that's actually where we can probably have the most useful learning. So learning from our everyday work instead of the really unusual cases at either end of the spectrum. What do you think about that?
Yeah, absolutely agree. So I think that, you know, safety one is probably the knee-jerk response that we still do, but that's your real conventional patient safety principles there. And as we move forward with patient safety, thinking about more contemporary ways to do it, learning from what we do well and just learning from our everyday should be done a lot more. And routine clinical debriefing would really align with that.
Yeah, because that's most of our work is the everyday.
Exactly, yeah.
And that's where safety is most of the time. So that feels very sensible to me.
I think another huge benefit of doing it more routinely is actually we get people used to doing it. So staff think, right, well, at the end of every shift or at the end of every theatre list or whatever that routine event is, we do a debrief and we talk about stuff that happened during the day. As and when a prompted clinical debriefing is done after something that is a bit more emotive, that people maybe afterwards think they just want to go away, not talk about it, maybe won't process their feelings properly. Actually, they're already used to the concept of clinical debriefing and maybe more willing to participate, and that might be more successful. So I think there's real benefits on both sides to doing it more commonly.
Love that. I think that's really important. Just normalizing that in everyday practice means people aren't sort of freaking out if you propose a debrief after your medical emergency, thinking that something
100%. Yeah.
Okay. So I guess it might be useful to talk about how we actually facilitate a clinical debrief if either you're leading it or you're participating in it. And it might be useful to talk about some of the tools that are out there and what kind of things are useful to include in a clinical debrief.
That really links to one of the values we were talking about, which is the skills or the perceived lack of skills. And that's something I'm particularly interested in. You'd mentioned my master's project, which was looking at clinical debriefing tools. So I knew there was one or two out there, and there's certainly one in Lothian that is used quite commonly. That's the STOP5 tool. But I was coming across these other ones and I thought, wow, this is so interesting. There's all these different tools that exist. What are they doing? How are they doing it differently? And are they working? So we know that using a tool, and I'll give you some examples of other ones in case you want to look them up. So there's Info, there's Talk, there's Discern. There's a huge number of them. Those are some of the more frequently cited ones. We know that these can provide standardization, structure, and consistency. So a benefit of that is that they're likely to reduce the need for a very experienced facilitator. So in the middle of a night shift, you might not necessarily have someone on shift who's done a million clinical debriefs before. But having a tool in front of them with some aids and prompts for how to work through a clinical debrief might make that a little bit easier. My big caveat to that would be, of course, for any complex or particularly emotive cases, you probably should hang on to get a more experienced facilitator on board. But we've kind of alluded to that already in terms of if it has been a particularly challenging case, getting someone with a bit more experience.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. And I guess that's just emphasizing our point that really we're talking about debriefing to learn using these tools. And actually, if it's been an emotive one, then move into that managed zone. So you've mentioned a few tools, I guess, because we're both in Southeast Scotland and we're both familiar with the STOP5 tool. It might be useful just to talk about what's in that and the time it takes and things, just to give people a wee bit of an idea for what it might look like.
Yeah, absolutely. So the STOP5 tool, this was initially created in the emergency department in NHS Lothian, and I think is being used in various different areas, including post-cardiac arrest across the hospital. The idea of being called the STOP5, so STOP stands for summarise the case, things that went well, opportunities to improve, and points to action and responsibilities. So that's essentially the key parts of the debrief that are moved through. And the five is that it should be conducted in 5 minutes. So they published this a couple of years ago, so you can find it just by googling STOP5, and I would encourage people to do so because it's a lovely example of just a nice simple tool, really easy to use, has some good evidence behind it in terms of improving particularly staff reactions and also looking at processes within the emergency department, and is, I think, a good tool that's out there and available for people to use if they want one.
Yeah, and I think one of the useful things about that one, which I think a few of them have, is that they explicitly have that reactions phase, so checking the temperature in the room, and also have a little introduction spiel that you can just read out if you're not someone who's done a lot of debriefing before. So I think it makes it very easy. And I guess one of the other barriers we talked about is time, and this is 5 minutes, so yeah. Time shouldn't really be too much of an issue if you try and stick to that as a structure. So if you are the person that's facilitating, so the person that's debriefing, who do you think this should be in the team? I wonder if you've got any thoughts on that. And also, do you think this person needs to have had specific training if they're using a tool like this? Or do you think it can be someone who's just done a wee bit of reading on it and thinks this would be a good thing to do?
So I think to answer your latter question first, I think that probably depends on the tool. Having looked at a lot of these tools, you've got ones that are really simple, straightforward, 4 or 5 points in them that are fairly intuitive. And I've seen other ones that actually there's a lot more to them and a bit more nuance in maybe going down one side or the other side of the algorithm. So it probably depends what that tool's design is and what its intention for use is. The idea of a tool is that it should hopefully remove a little bit of the need for facilitator training. But I would propose that at least some short training in doing a clinical debrief, especially things like picking up staff that aren't okay and how to safety net for that. I think I probably would recommend that, even if that's something like a short online module that can be conducted, just so people are confident in actually implementing the tool that they're using. And then to jump back to your first question, which is, I guess, who's doing this facilitating? And that's really challenging because we don't always necessarily have that experienced facilitator on a shift with us. I think we quite often jump to thinking that the facilitator should be the senior doctor who's been in charge of a situation. So whether that's the med reg running a cardiac arrest, the consultant anaesthetist who was running the case that didn't go to plan. But actually, maybe if we look outside the pool, we might increase the number of people that are able to facilitate. So the info tool, which was published by Rose et al., they designed that tool specifically to be used by charge nurses in the emergency department, which is a great idea. The charge nurses are always around. They've got good clinical knowledge. They understand the system that they're working in, but they maybe haven't necessarily got five other patients that they need to go and look after at that time. They've got quite a good overall understanding of what's going in the department in terms of when to conduct that debrief. So maybe just thinking outside of the pool of doctors, who else can do this debrief? And maybe also tapping into people that have transferable skills. So there's some evidence that suggests people who have experience in simulation debriefing can probably transfer those skills across to clinical debriefing. So actually, who are our sim facilitators in our department? Are those people that we could try and get on board to become the clinical debriefing facilitators as well?
Yeah, I think that's really useful to think it doesn't have to be the team lead. And I guess sometimes it might even be challenging for it to be the team lead in terms of participants being able to speak up against a hierarchy, perhaps. Team leads might benefit from being a participant in the debrief as opposed to leading it, I often think.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been on that side where I've been the senior person that has then led the debrief and I've walked away going, oh, I wish someone had checked I was all right. You know, so I guess there's a responsibility of the team there to check in on each other. But yeah, the team lead is possibly, and I would maybe hazard to say probably, not actually the best person to lead a debrief.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I like the thought about the charge nurses as well. I think the other benefit is they're like permanent staff. So they're people that are in the department permanently, so just sort of rotating doctors. And in terms of embedding a culture, they feel like a really good person to be leading that. And I wonder in sort of other parts of the hospital, maybe the resus officers could be a good group as well, perhaps for that. Or hospital at night practitioners, you know, there's loads of people who are permanent and who are consistently on cardiac arrest or emergency teams that could be useful. And just thinking about if we are the participants in a debrief, what can they do? What's their role within that? And what can maybe they do to make this a meaningful exercise?
I think that's a kind of challenging question because I suppose we're putting the clinical debrief there for them, aren't we? And importantly, I think if people aren't willing or aren't ready to participate in a clinical debriefing, sitting them down and making them do it is probably not very helpful. So assessing a willingness to participate, which we can hopefully aid by explaining what it is, what its function is, what its benefits are, but not forcing people to participate if it's just not right for them at that point in time. Once they're in the room and once we're doing the debrief, enabling them to understand what it is that we're doing by having that little spiel at the start. This is what we're going to talk about. This is how long it's going to take, and really setting that scene and allowing them just to, I guess, work within their comfort levels. So that's probably more as facilitators, what we can do to help the participants. As a participant, I think you just need to do what you're happy to do. Contribute if you think you can or should, but if you don't feel like there's something that you want to contribute, that's okay as well. If you're just wanting to sit there and listen, then that's totally fine. So just take it as it is and don't feel too pressured that you have to behave in a certain way.
Yeah, I think that's really helpful. And I guess some of the things we're alluding to is that concept of psychological safety in debriefing, which is a big feature of simulation debriefing. I wonder what you think about the similarities or differences in clinical debriefing compared to simulation debriefing. Can we take some things we learn from one into the other in terms of facilitation?
Yeah, I definitely agree. So there's lots of similarities and also lots of differences between simulation and clinical debriefing. And I think one of the big similarities is that requirement for psychological safety. So just for anyone that's not come across that concept before, that's defined as being able to take interpersonal risks in a specific context, feeling able to speak your minds without fear of ridicule, embarrassment, or punishment. And that's a concept that's really, really embedded and incredibly well established in simulation-based education already. So after doing your scenario, you sit down for a debrief, the facilitator at all points will really try to emphasize, actually, you know, we're here to learn, we're not here to blame, mistakes are okay. I suppose the big difference between simulation and clinical environment is that mistakes, while we can still absolutely learn from them and we can take things into future practice, some mistakes might need to be explored a little bit more in terms of if patient harm happened, why did that happen? Is there something that we need to change as part of our team working or as part of our processes or our system that might have actually reduced the potential for that patient harm? So there's a slightly different way to approach it, just in terms of these are real patients and we're not as free and easy to make mistakes as a learning opportunity as we are in simulation. But I think when we're doing the clinical debrief itself, setting up that psychological safety, there's lots of things from the simulation literature that we can definitely embed to try and make sure that participants are feeling as psychologically safe possible. So some examples might be actually getting a physical space away from where the clinical event took place. So not standing around the patient room where the patient just had a cardiac arrest, getting yourself off to a coffee room or a meeting room, somewhere that's just away, private, you're not going to get interrupted. During the debrief, making sure that everyone's been introduced, everyone understands what the expectations of the debrief are. We've already talked about that a little bit. And reassuring everyone that the discussions aren't going to be with a blame focus, they're going to be blame free, and thinking about learning. And importantly, that there'll be confidentiality during that conversation as well.
I think those are really useful points to take through from simulation debriefing to clinical debriefing. And that psychological safety is an important thing to talk about. So thanks for going through that with us. So I think we've talked a lot about why we're doing clinical debriefing, when we should do it, some of the tools that people can use to facilitate clinical debriefing. And we've talked about some of the barriers at the start. And I'm wondering whether you have any thoughts on how can we embed clinical debriefing within our department? What do you think?
So yeah, again, we've mentioned the barrier of culture, which I think is probably the biggest barrier that there is to actually making this happen and to embedding it as a thing that we do frequently in a department. So a one-off debrief here or there, very, very useful, but actually getting that established as a normal practice can be a little bit more challenging. There's lots of facets to that. Partly some people just don't see the point in it. The attitudes might be wrong. Or a department or a hospital maybe just isn't at the right place at that time to participate in a change process if there is a lot of other stuff going on, which we all understand. We work in really, really busy hospitals and there's always challenges that we're trying to manage. So there's a really nice model, which is the Cotter's model for change. And that talks about different steps that we can use to try and initiate change. And there's some of these that I think might be quite relevant for clinical debriefing. So one of them is creating a guiding coalition. And I suppose sounds easy, but it's actually potentially difficult, but getting the right people on board. So thinking about people from the bottom up, but also from the up down. So on the ground, who are your clinicians? Who are your nursing staff? Who are your people that actually want to do the debriefing and want to participate in the debriefing? But also, who are the managers? Who are the people in charge of the department that are going to have a little bit of oversight of whether this is something that can realistically be implemented? So thinking about those people and other stakeholders is really useful, trying to get them on board and get them to try and drive things forward. There's another step of that Cotter's model that I really like, which is planning for short-term wins. So we always think about wanting to have, you know, lots of data to show that we're doing the right thing, and that's brilliant. And if you get to a stage with your clinical debriefing program that you have some strong data, fantastic. But actually sometimes little short-term wins are enough to get people on board. Oh, we did a clinical debriefing after that situation that happened there. And after that, we changed the protocol. And then the next time we did that thing, the protocol worked and we did everything really smoothly. That kind of stuff does win people over and they start to see the benefit of it, and that effect kind of snowballs. Importantly, just accepting that it's not going to happen overnight. So one of Cotter's steps is institutionalizing the change. That is hard to do. That takes time. That takes lots of people and a lot of effort, no matter what the change is. So implementing clinical debriefing programs will take a little bit of time with a little bit of effort.
I think it's really useful to think about it in the Cotter's change model and just using, I guess, really good quality improvement methodology to think about making that change, and that these are small steps that take a long time, and having patience and being able to continue to drive on. And those short-term wins, I guess, are one of the things that keeps you going when you're trying to make changes in a department. And I've got a couple of things that I've been trying in my own practice in terms of, I guess, tips and tricks to try and get the clinical debrief embedded a bit more in what I do.
Love to hear them.
One of the things I've been trying is to do it at the cardiac arrest huddle at the start of the shift. So as part of my cardiac arrest huddle, where I allocate roles in the cardiac arrest team and do a bit of a spiel about sort of speaking up and things like that, I've also started to say, you know, we might do a clinical debrief and this is what it involves. And I say, would anyone be interested in leading this if they've got simulation debriefing experience or if they've done it before, and maybe allocate a lead for that before. If you've got like a IMT doctor who's done a bit of sim debriefing, that can work quite well. And then perhaps you're covering the clarity of purpose at that point, as well as explaining that it might happen in an expectation setting way, so people don't think she's debriefing because this has gone wrong or because we've done something badly here. And I guess the other thing I often think is that this takes too much time fallacy, because it's 5 minutes, that actually it's 5 minutes that are going to improve the performance of your team and potentially your patient outcomes. So I think about that in terms of, well, I can spare 5 minutes to call a relative about a patient that's unwell, so why can't I spare 5 minutes to do this? So just, if we think it's important enough, then I will make time for it. And I guess that's just changing how I think about it in my own head. And finally, I think people think that everyone just sort of drifts off after a cardiac arrest or an emergency and it's difficult to get people back in the room. But actually, you don't have to have every single person back in that room. It's like, perfect is the enemy of good sometimes. And actually, if you can have some people who are in that clinical debrief and you can have some learning from that, then go for that. Don't feel like you need to have it perfect. That's my sort of thoughts over the last couple of years. What do you think, Emma?
I absolutely agree with that. I love that Voltaire quote, perfect is the enemy of good. I put that in a lot of my presentations. So I think alluding to, yeah, who's there, and also the time element. So 5 minutes isn't very long. You're not going to talk about every single thing that happened in that room in 5 minutes. So don't feel like you have to. Just try and get something out of it. Get the key points. And again, working that into your description of the clinical debrief, like, we're not here to cover every single thing. We're here to try and learn something from what happened. But if you're trying to squeeze out every single potential learning point, it's going to take you more than 5 minutes. Yeah. And I love the idea of prefacing the team at the huddle. What a great opportunity, because you've already got everyone there in one room. And like you say, that's expectation setting. So they're not just thinking, oh, we're doing a debrief because that didn't all go really well. I think I might steal that idea actually and use that one for theatre teams. I think other little tips and tricks, I don't know if this is a bit sneaky, but if I maybe anticipate that the people I'm working with at that time aren't necessarily going to be open to a clinical debrief, I just don't call it a clinical debrief. I just say, can we just hang on and have a quick chat about what happened? And it can be as informal as that. I've talked about using tools, and I think that's a fantastic way to do it under a more formalized setting. But actually, sometimes just, can we just have a quick chat about what happened there? You can get people chatting for a few minutes and elicit the learning points from something like that. So that sounds a bit sneaky. So maybe that's not what I should be saying, but getting people on board in whatever way you think is going to work.
Yeah, I think that's fair. We're not saying there's one right way to do this. You know, there's lots of ways that you can do this, and just trying to give people the tools to be able to think about how they can start doing clinical debriefing in practice. So I don't think it's too sneaky.
I've just actually thought of another term for clinical debriefing, and I'm sorry, I can't remember who it is. So if they're listening, I apologize. But someone on Twitter said that they called it a tea brief, with the idea being, you know, it doesn't need to be formal. After something happens, you all sit down, you have a cup of tea, and you have a conversation about it, which I think is cool as well.
Yeah, that's the one I'm going to steal. Tea brief. Cool. So we started off with a case of mine where we didn't debrief, and I always thought, I kind of wish we'd had a chat about that one afterwards. Do you have any examples where a debrief did happen and actually that was a positive thing?
Yeah, there's one in particular that jumps to mind, and this was from, must have been a night shift. Things tend to happen in night shifts and obstetrics, but obstetric theatres. And essentially what happened was the patient bled a lot and none of us in the room picked up this bleed until very late in the game. Patient care all occurred as we figured out she was bleeding, everything happened, and she was absolutely fine in the end, as was baby. But we had a clinical debrief afterwards led by one of the charge midwives. So again, I thought she was an excellently placed person at that time. And one of the massive learning points that came out of that is that actually quite a lot of blood had gathered in amongst one of the little bags that sits in the theatre drapes. So I think there was about a litre and a half, 2 litres of blood in there that we hadn't noticed. So based on that event, actually we embedded having suction sitting in that bag for gathering blood, which is so easy, right? You just think that's such an easy, obvious thing to do, but we weren't doing it. And now in that hospital, the suction always gets sat into the bag so that if there's loads of blood gathering that we're not seeing, it goes straight into the suction and we can count it. So I thought that was a really nice, like, simple learning point that came out of that debrief. And another thing for me that was really highlighted there is that there was a student midwife. That was her first time in theatre, and it wasn't a slick, easy case. And she was very, very shaken up. I think she just thought, gosh, this is what obstetrics is like every time you come to theatre. And I don't think that necessarily be picked up before we all sat down in that room and had that debrief. So it was an opportunity for actually her clinical mentors to be able to just have a chat with her afterwards and reassure her that this does happen, doesn't happen to every single patient. So that was a really nice, I guess, thinking about both that debrief to learn and debrief to manage that came out of that case.
Yeah, that's a really great example. And I like the thought that you can do debrief to learn and debrief to manage as well. If you're picking up something, then you can follow that up or get someone to follow that up who's well placed within that team for that student midwife. So that's also a useful learning point for me as well. Okay, so we talked about lots of stuff. So we talked about why clinical debriefing is important, what we mean when we're talking about it, when should we do it, how should we do it, how can we try and embed it within our departments, given we've given lots of proof that it's something that we should be doing more. I wonder if you've got any sort of take-home messages that you want the listeners to take away and perhaps put into their practice in the future.
So, I mean, what I would love to say as my take-home message is, let's all do clinical debriefing after everything, but that is not realistic. So what I would suggest to people is be open to it if the opportunity arises and just try and get used to talking about how things go. So even if that's a one-on-one conversation at the end of a routine clinical day, just starting having those types of conversations. And I've talked about that snowball effect before. I think things will snowball, and just try and be open to participating if it happens.
Yeah, I think that's a really useful note to end on. So thanks so much, Emma, for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been brilliant, Kat.
And I hope that's been really useful to the listeners, and I hope you join us next time. Thank you so much.